Hello, I'm Claire. I'm going to be reading the Bible this morning. If you would like one of our church Bibles, just pop your hand up and an usher will bring one round for you. We're going to be reading Ruth chapter 1, which in the church Bibles is on page 229. During the time of the judges, there was a famine in the land. A man left Bethlehem in Judah with his wife and two sons to stay in the territory of Moab for a while. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They entered the fields of Moab and settled there. Naomi's husband, Elimelech, died, and she was left with her two sons. Her sons took Moabite women as their wives. One was named Orpah, and the second was named Ruth. After they lived in Moab about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two children and without her husband. She and her daughters-in-laws set out to return from the territory of Moab because she had heard in Moab that the Lord had paid attention to his people's needs by providing them food. She left the place where she had been living, accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, and travelled along the road leading back to the land of Judah. Naomi said to them, "Each of you go back to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to the dead and to me. May the Lord grant each of you rest in the house of a new husband." She kissed them and they wept loudly. They said to her, "We insist on returning with you and to your people." But Naomi replied, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you want to go with me? Am I able to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me to have a husband tonight and to bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to grow up? Would you restrain yourselves from remarrying? No, my daughters, my life is much too bitter for you to share, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." Again they wept loudly. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Follow your sister-in-law." But Ruth replied, "Don't plead with me to abandon you or to return and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me and do so severely if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped talking to her. The two of them travelled until they came to Bethlehem. When they entered Bethlehem, the whole town was excited about their arrival, and the local women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," she answered, "for the Almighty has made me very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has opposed me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi came back from the territory of Moab with her daughter-in-law Ruth, the Moabitess. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest.
Well, I just want to say that is a bit like how decisions get made in the Anglican Church. And it's also some of our plans for 9 Lombard Street that we're hoping will come about. I mean, it helps that he lives on a national park, or he's got the biggest house in the world. But I thought about trying to make something like that on the stage and get all the things to happen, but I realised I'd have to set it up for 9 and then set it up for 11, so we watch a video. So there we go. Hope you enjoyed it. But how good are those kinds of things? It turns out there are 9 trillion of them on YouTube, but someone has spent ages planning that, where all the things are exactly where they need to be, and it all just works. The angles are right, the timing is right. This hits at just the right spot so that it causes that to happen over there, which pushes this all out, and it all just plays out. And I want to say, the reason we showed that video is I want to say that's like what God does in our lives and in the world and in history. Every detail, every moment, every angle, the timing and the placement and the direction of things is all part of his plan. From beginning to end, nothing is an accident, nothing's left to chance. But I also want to say it's not quite exactly the same as that, is it? Because God doesn't just kind of set things up, give it a bit of a push, sit back and film it or watch it and do nothing. No, everything happens the way God wants it to, not just because he planned it all out beforehand, but because he's always personally and actively involved in making it all happen. And besides, how many times did they have to film that? Try that, get it wrong, have to practice it, have to move things, go back to the beginning, change things, try again. The guy who made that said it took a month to set all of that up, and then another month to get it to successfully work. That's a serious amount of time and investment. But here's the thing, God gets it right first time, every time. And God isn't just doing one thing, got to follow this ball as it goes down and does this thing one at a time. He's running the whole universe. How good is our God? You know what? At the same time, all of that means that seemingly insignificant things, unimportant moments, ordinary events, are absolutely vital in the grand plan of God. One little domino falling, one little cup tipping over, one little ping pong ball bouncing and then nudging that thing, it all has this ongoing cause and effect, triggering and rippling all of the things to happen, but it's all bringing about God's purposes. This is what the Bible teaches us. God uses ordinary people like ours. He uses our ordinary lives and weaves it together in his extraordinary plan, where everything works to achieve his great purpose of seeing more and more people saved to the glory of Jesus Christ. And you know what? We see a great example of this in the book of Ruth. God is in control. God has a plan of every detail, the little ones, the random ones. How did that happen? And he has a plan. And as we step back, even from the small events, we see how that fits into the extraordinary eternal purposes of God. And so we're going to try and cover the whole of Ruth. And it starts in chapter 1. Now the story of Ruth goes somewhere really significant. Just like that video, it has a beginning and an end, but it actually achieves something. The book begins with death, but moves to life. It starts with emptiness, but moves to fullness and plenty. It goes from curse and being separated to being blessed and united and belonging, because it's all part of God's plan. I've chopped this talk up into three sections, and then we'll sing a song in between each section just to kind of help us move our way through the whole book. And the first section is Ruth commits to God and to God's people. See, chapter 1 is a sad beginning, but with a silver lining. We see that there's a famine in the land. Now, this is the land meant to be flowing with milk and honey. This is the promised land of peace and prosperity, and there's so much food you don't even have to work for it. You just go out and get it. So now that there's a famine, we know there's something wrong. Things aren't as they should be. There's a problem between God and his people. The land that's meant to be a sign of God's blessing is now kind of barren. It's like the land was good until Israel got there, but now they've corrupted it with their sin. Just like back in the beginning, Adam and Eve, humanity corrupted the world with sin, and things aren't as they should be. So the family of Elimelech, his wife Naomi, their two sons Mahlon and Chilion, decide to move to a foreign country to try and stay there to find some food, to find a living. But what happens is they go to all this effort to find somewhere better, to improve their lives, to be fruitful and productive. They've tried to solve a problem by going there, but it gets worse. When they're there, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, dies. And it says she's left with her two sons. And verse 4, while they were there, the boys got married. Now that's a problem, because God had specifically told his people they were not to marry foreign women. Not because of racism, but because of the gods they worship. Don't be joined with them in their lifestyle. Don't be joined with them in their worship of false gods and ignoring the one true God. Yet the sons marry two Moabite women, Orpah, who had a very successful daytime talk show, and Ruth. Then the tragedy continues. Verse 5, both Mahlon and Chilion died. And Naomi is left without a husband and without her two sons. She's tried to get away from a land with no food. And now she has no husband and no sons. She's reached a really low point. But in verse 6, she hears that Yahweh, the Lord, has brought food to the land of Israel. And so she gets up to return, to go back. But along the way, as she takes her daughters-in-law with her, she says to Ruth and to Orpah, actually, you should go back to your homes. You've been really kind to me and to my family, but now you should go home. I'm not sure why she says this to them halfway back to Bethlehem. Why not at the start of the journey? Why not before they even left? But it's like Naomi is ashamed and embarrassed to come back. She left with a husband and with sons and is now returning without them, but with these random Gentiles. She feels like she has nothing to offer her daughters-in-law. She can't give them more sons to marry. She can't provide what they need. So she tries to send them away. Now they refuse. They want to go with her. They want to go with her to her people, but she insists. And eventually Orpah turns back to her home. But Ruth refuses to go and clings to Naomi. And listen to what she says in verse 16. Listen to this awesome expression of loyalty and love and family and commitment. Verse 16. But Ruth replied, "Don't plead with me to abandon you or to return and not follow you, for wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me and do so severely if anything but death separates you and me." And in part, the reason Ruth is a heroine for all of us to look up to is because of the way she shows such deep loyalty to Naomi. In fact, Ruth's name means friend. And that is exactly what she is. This is deep friendship, isn't it? I am with you no matter what. No matter how bad it gets, I am by your side. I will go everywhere with you. Such a blessing from God to have a friend like that. But it's more than friendship and family, because Orpah loves Naomi a lot, but she heads home. But Ruth actually changes sides. She comes from a different nation and a different home, worshipping different gods, living a different way. And here she's saying, "Your God will be my God." She is all in on this. She's saying no to her past life, her previous connections and her identity. And she decides she wants to belong to God and to belong to God's people. It's a vow and a commitment that she makes before Yahweh, before the Lord. And what she's showing us here is that belonging to God and being one of God's people, committing to God means being all in. You can't be half-baked. You can't be lukewarm. You can't be a bit of this, a bit of that. I want to have a bit of both ways. You're all in, or you're not there at all. But the chapter ends on a sour note. Because when they actually arrive at Bethlehem, the people recognize Naomi. Ah, she's come back. Listen to what Naomi says in verse 20. "Don't call me Naomi." Naomi means sweet, pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made me very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has opposed me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" She says, "Call me bitter." But here's the thing, even after Ruth's love, Ruth's commitment and her loyalty and her friendship, in fact, her conversion, Naomi says, "I have nothing." And that's the problem, isn't it, sometimes? Sometimes we are so focused on our pain that we won't let it go. We are so defined by our suffering, we think that's our identity and value. We're so fixated on what we don't have that we miss the beautiful things that we do have given to us by God. Ruth is an amazing blessing in Naomi's life, but she says, "I have nothing, I am empty." Well, that's the setup for the story, chapter 1. We're going to see what happens next after we sing this song. So let's stand and sing together praises to our great God. Well, I've called this section of Ruth's story, "You Reap What You Sow." It's because it covers chapters 2 and 3, which follows this theme of seeking and finding that take place around the harvest. So there's a whole lot of harvesting and reaping happening, but it's also we see that Ruth starts to reap what she had sown in her generosity and kindness. And you see at the beginning of chapter 2 that Ruth and Naomi get together to make a plan, and so Ruth goes out to glean. Now, gleaning is basically picking up the leftovers. As the harvesters are going through the field, bringing in the grain, any bits that are left behind, the gleaning is just picking those up off the ground. Now, verse 3 is interesting because it says, Ruth happened to be in the field that belonged to Boaz, who happened to be connected to Elimelech's family. And it's this little detail. She happened to, it looks like it's random, she just arrived in this field, but it's exactly where God needs her to be, wants her to be. God is in control. And as she's there gleaning, Boaz notices her in the field. He doesn't know her, hasn't met her, and so he asks who she is. And when he finds out, listen to what he says in verse 8 of chapter 2. Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, don't go and gather grain in another field. Don't leave this one, but stay here, close to my female servants. See which field they are harvesting and follow them. Haven't I ordered the young men not to touch you? When you are thirsty, go and drink from the jars the young men have filled." And she fell face down, bowed to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor with you, so that you notice me, although I am a foreigner?" See, Boaz is kind to her and generous to her. He offers her protection. He offers her help. He says, "Come and be part of my crew." And when she asks, why are you being kind to me? Why, I'm a foreigner, why are you doing this? Then we know that if this was a romantic comedy, it would be because sparks had flown between them. In fact, it had probably been because as he turned to face her, she took off her glasses and everyone could finally see that she's actually beautiful. That's what would happen in the movies. But listen to what Boaz says. This is way deeper. Verse 11. Boaz answered her, "Everything you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death has been fully reported to me. How you left your father and mother and your native land, and how you came to a people you didn't previously know. May the Lord reward you for what you have done. May you receive a full reward from the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." You see that? What impresses Boaz is not, "Oh, wow, she's pretty, I'm going to be nice to her." He's impressed by her commitment. He's impressed by her generous care and her love for Naomi. He sees that what she's done is actually joining God's team, God's people, and coming under God's protection. And he respects her and admires her for that. See, she had sown generosity, loyalty, selflessness, and what she reaps here is the same. She didn't know this was going to happen, but Boaz is generous to her. He asks her to join the meal and they dip their bread in vinegar for some reason. And then he gives her extra grain. He says to his harvesters, "Leave lots behind for her." So here is this woman who's committed to looking after Naomi as a friend, and what she has found is a friend who is there to look after her. Then in chapter 3, Naomi and Ruth again get together to make a plan. And this time, after the day's harvest, while Boaz is asleep in the harvesting area, Ruth goes in, lies at his feet, and covers them to keep them warm. And in one sense, that's a strange thing to do, and perhaps a little scandalous in one sense, but the passage makes it very clear nothing improper happens. Because look at how Boaz takes it in verse 10 of chapter 3. So we're in chapter 3 now. Verse 10, he wakes up and he asks the same question he asked in chapter 2. Who is this? Who are you? She says, "I'm Ruth." Same in chapter 3. Who are you? "I'm Ruth. Take me under your wing," she says. Verse 10, he says to her, then he said, "May the Lord bless you, my daughter. You have shown more kindness now than before, because you have not pursued younger men, whether rich or poor. Now don't be afraid, my daughter. I will do for you whatever you say, since all the people in my town know that you are a woman of noble character." See, that is that word kindness again. He's impressed. "Ruth, wow, you are kinder than I even realized." And it's what makes her a heroine. It's interesting. She doesn't fight a mighty battle. She doesn't defeat armies. She doesn't conquer nations. But she has real courage and she is kind. And what she is beginning to experience more and more is God's kindness to her and his faithfulness. You know, God had promised centuries before this to Abraham, you're going to have so many kids you can't count them. And anyone who blesses your offspring, I will bless them. And anyone who curses them, I will curse. And here is Ruth well and truly on the side of Abraham's descendants, and God is on her side. The promised faithful love and kindness that God had shown Israel is now overflowing and including this Gentile woman, Ruth. This is great news for the whole world, for all the nations, that God's love reaches even them. Well, we're going to sing one more time before we finish our story. So let's stand together, sing our next song. One of the joys of watching movies with our kids as they grew up was the 4,872 questions that you'd get all the way through the movie. So even at the opening scene, they'd be like, who's that? What are they doing? Why are they having breakfast? Why are they not having breakfast? Why did that happen? Are they the good guy? Are they the bad guy? What's happening? Why did that happen? And the answer was usually wait and see. Wait and see. You need to keep watching. You need to see how the story plays out to understand why that mattered and what that character was doing. Just wait. It will all become clear at the end. And maybe if you were reading the Bible and you'd start at the beginning and you got to Ruth, you'd wonder, why am I hearing this story? We've had the judges who've pretty spectacular military victories, but also pretty broken people. We're about to get to Samuel, who's a mighty man of God, and then we're going to get to David and the kings. And why have we got Ruth in the middle of all that? Well, chapter 4 very nicely pulls all the threads, all the loose ends of Ruth together, including some threads we may not have even noticed initially. Chapter 4 starts with Boaz calling the town elders together because he would like to marry Ruth. But as it turns out, there is someone whose family responsibility it is ahead of him in the line of commitment. See, in Israel, in the Old Testament times, if a married man died without having children, then his brother was to marry the widow and give her children who would continue the line and the inheritance of the dead brother. The whole point being that the family line would continue, wasn't erased from Israel. It's about continuity and passing on through time God's blessing and God's people. Now, there are no brothers, but the closest relative is this man. Now, Boaz is clever and quite wise in the way he handles this whole situation, because he says to the guy in verse 3 of chapter 4, he said to the Redeemer, the kinsman Redeemer, that's the title of the person who was committed to save in the situation. He said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has returned from the territory of Moab, is selling the portion of the field that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should inform you, buy it back in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you want to redeem it, do it. But if you do not want to redeem it, tell me so that I will know, because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it, and I am next after you. I want to redeem it, he answered. So the setup is Naomi has land and she's willing to sell it. Guy, you have first option. But if you don't want it, I'll take it. And the guy is, of course, I'll buy it. He's going to increase his land. He's going to increase the inheritance that his family will have. And having set it up like that, then Boaz can add in the extra detail. Oh, great. But along with the opportunity to buy the land is the duty and the responsibility and the obligation to marry Ruth. And at that point, the man changes his mind. Now, Boaz has very wisely and astutely arranged it so that it isn't actually all about Ruth. If he'd started with the idea of marriage, the guy would look like a lawbreaker when he said no, or he looks like he doesn't care about family commitment. But he basically gives the guy a way out by putting it in terms of land and inheritance, because if that man had married Ruth, their children would inherit Elimelech's land and they would inherit his land. So his family land would then be actually become part of Elimelech's line. The system kept the line of the firstborns. but at the expense of those who came after. That's why brothers were very often reluctant to do this. It's an act of generous selflessness and sacrifice for the sake of others. So the man politely declines. It doesn't make any sense for him and his family. Verse 6, he says, well, actually, no thanks. And what that means is everybody wins. Everybody wins. And we get to this random detail that I'm going to read just because it's weird and funny. In verse 7, at an earlier period in Israel, a man removed his sandal and gave it to the other party in order to make any matter legally binding concerning the right of redemption or the exchanging of property. This was the method of legally binding a transaction in Israel. So the redeemer removed his sandal and said to Boaz, buy back the property yourself. And just to let you know, we did try that with Morris when we put down the deposit for 9 Lombard just before Christmas, but it turns out that the warden sandals weren't good enough for him, even though some of them were Birkenstocks, but it didn't work. Here's a shoe. Nope, doesn't work. But that's how they kind of made it legally binding. But look at how it's all come together, though. Naomi has been paid for this field, so she has means to provide for herself now. Ruth is now a fully fledged member of Israel in the community. She's accepted and redeemed and married into the line. Boaz has got to fulfill his family responsibilities. And so in the end, Boaz and Ruth marry, and God gives them a son. And there is this beautiful moment at the end of chapter 4 where Naomi realizes just how much she had all along with Ruth. Remember she said at chapter 1, call me Mara, call me bitter, because I have nothing. I am empty. God has cursed me, taken away everything good. Listen to what the women say about Naomi now in verse 14. The women said to Naomi, this is after the birth of Ruth's son, blessed be the Lord who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Indeed, your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him, to Obed. I love that. Blessed be God, the Lord. They know this is all about God. He's the one behind this. But hear what they say. Ruth is better to you than 7 sons. Ruth loves you. You thought you were empty, but you had Ruth. Her loyalty, her commitment, her love, her generosity, her friendship. God was at work in Naomi's life. And so verse 16, I love this extra little detail. Naomi took the child, Obed means servant, placed him on her lap and became his nanny. The neighbor women said, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is so good. It's like Naomi has got to have another son. A boy to love and to raise and to look after, even after she said it can never happen, chapter 1. I want us to notice one more thing, though, as we look at Ruth. The story finishes on a much grander scale than Ruth's faithfulness and loyalty being blessed by God. It's much bigger ending than the love and the giving of each other that Ruth and Boaz share. They become a family. It turns out the story is more than just how Ruth and Naomi go from empty to full and hopeless to blessed. This story is actually a key moment in how God gets from Adam and Eve sinning and making a mess of everything to Jesus being born to die and fix everything. This is a critical moment because chapter 4 finishes by telling us, kind of randomly, but putting it there so that as you see the whole picture, you realize. Ruth and Boaz have a son called Obed. Obed grows up and has a son called Jesse. Jesse grows up and has a son called David, the king of Israel, David, who is promised personally by God. I will give you a son who will be born in your hometown of Bethlehem. He will reign over my kingdom forever and he will make everything right. Ruth is David's great-grandmother. Ruth saying, I'm coming to your land. Ruth being loyal to Naomi. Ruth marrying Boaz after all the things worked out is how David's line is how Jesus' line is continued. Through this moment, through the generations, Jesus is born. God is in control of everything. He has an extraordinary plan to save the world through Jesus Christ. And in his kindness and generosity, he includes our ordinariness personal ordinariness, our church's ordinariness, to achieve his extraordinary plan, to glorify Jesus, to see people saved, to make everything right. And so sometimes we are concentrating on what we don't have, and we think, oh man, God's not on my side, or I don't have anything to offer. But this story is a great reminder. God is in control. God is involved. And even in our ordinary lives, he is achieving something extraordinary through Jesus Christ. So we're going to spend some time in prayer now, and Roz is going to lead us in prayer. So let me hand over to Roz.
Good morning.